Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hosted by Dr. Nicely, that's my voice you're hearing, and with as guest today, Dr. Professor Anna Marie Griffiths of Toronto, the Hospital for Sick Children. Inflammatory bowel disease is important to assess, to treat, and to follow correctly, as Dr. Griffiths will confirm and emphasize for us today. She poses for us three questions. What are some of the consequences for the patient when caregivers mislabel the type of inflammatory bowel disease? What purpose is served by thorough diagnostic evaluation at presentation with upper endoscopy, ileocolonoscopy, and small bowel imaging? And what are the goals to be achieved by using the Paris classification or any of its modifications? And this touches on something that leaves me a bit at a loss, and that is the use of these various classifications, how they've changed over the years, how those changes have reflected changes in management, and what the prospects are for the future of inflammatory bowel disease classification and classification-related management. Dr. Griffiths has been at this game for quite some while. She came up through residency, through medical school, residency, post-residency training, and the academic ladder and the academic ladder up to her professorship, all at the University of Toronto and its affiliated institutions. So she's seen it all, and she's seen it at one institution, and she's beautifully positioned to comment, which I hope she'll start now.
Well, first of all, inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, is a term that's used to describe the situation where there's inflammation somewhere in the gastrointestinal tract and it's chronic. And we don't fully understand the cause, but we do know that it can take a number of forms. And so far, we usually classify it into either ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. The reality is that Crohn's disease is really more than one disease, so we like to talk about Crohn diseases. The classifications began way back. I think the first classification was called the Rome classification, and then from there, the Vienna, and then Montreal.
Okay, now we're finally on my radar screen, the Montreal classification, but it's only on my radar screen insofar as there was a pediatric modification by Levine et al.
Correct. So I'll tell you a bit about the Montreal, first of all. It was published in, I think, 2005, and this was around the heyday of exploration of genes that made people susceptible to developing inflammatory bowel disease. And so when people got together at a world congress, they wanted to classify IBD, but they were actually hoping they could improve on the earlier classifications by bringing in not just descriptive information, but instead genetic and what was called serologic, meaning antibodies. So they tried, but they decided that it was not ready for that. There wasn't enough known. So they ended up just with a descriptive classification. So then came along a group of pediatric gastroenterologists, and I was part of that. And in conjunction with a meeting in Paris, we made the Paris modification. And I think it was an improvement. We categorized different areas of the bowel that are commonly involved in children. We added a descriptor of whether or not growth was impaired, and we began to add a descriptor of whether or not the IBD was severe or not, but it was very preliminary. So that was the Paris classification. It's well used, I would say. I think in many pediatric units, the trainees are taught to describe patients according to the Paris classification. Mm-hmm. Now, what's happened since then, and what I was asked to talk about partly at this meeting, was that a group called IOIBD, which stands for International Organization of IBD. It also has been around for a long time, but it's been particularly active in the past 10 years or so. The people who make up IOIBD are dominantly adult gastroenterologists. There are some surgeons, and there are four pediatric gastroenterologists. And again, we were trying to improve on the existing classification. One of the things that's not present in the Paris and not present in the Montreal is any classification related to how the IBD evolves. Does it extend or progress rapidly or not at all? So there's an effort in the new classification, which is probably going to be called IOIBD 25, which means it's coming out in the year 2025. There's an effort to capture the time it takes a patient to develop a complication or have a severe episode.
So this is really based on clinical aspects of the disorder rather than on that will-o'-the-wisp genetic etiology.
Exactly. It still is purely descriptive. Mm-hmm. It's an improvement, but it doesn't yet bring in any molecular data. And that's unfortunate. You know, in the oncology field, as I'm sure you're aware, when someone is diagnosed to have a lymphoma or a solid tumor, there are generally markers from the tumor or in the bone marrow that can predict what therapy is needed for that patient. So it's the road to precision medicine.
Yes.
So we certainly hope that we might get there for IBD. We're not there yet.
Mm. Now, Espigan has certain criteria, or at least Levine et al. In 2014 articulated certain criteria, and I must say that IBD congresses take place in the most attractive settings, because this one was from Porto.
Yes, yes. And in fact, there's the Porto group of ESPGAN, which is a working group that meets annually in Porto. But
how do I join?
Well, the first step is to join the special interest group of ESPGAN and then submit an application. I think you could try.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
But the Porto criteria are a bit different than the classification. So what Porto criteria, it's a couple of things. Firstly, it sort of dictates what the diagnostic workup should be of a patient, but then it also instructs people how to interpret the data that they get from this diagnostic workup. And the purpose of the interpretation is primarily to come out with a verdict. Does this patient who has chronic bowel inflammation, is it looking like ulcerative colitis, or is it looking like a form of Crohn's disease? And yes, we can pull in the Paris classification, or we could pull in the IOIBD 25, but the big question that we're asking as part of the Porto criteria is it Crohn's or ulcerative colitis? Based on what things look like at endoscopy, based on what the biopsies show, I'm sure you can relate to that.
Yes. And based on imaging studies now.
And based on imaging.
Back in 2014, I'm not certain that ultrasonographic studies were a large part of the picture. Can you comment on that?
They were not as often used as they are now, which has really become routine, certainly in many parts of Europe. But interestingly, when you read the publication from 2014, they still talk about ultrasound. I think it was just coming into fairly common use, and so they do mention it. But you're right, it is now much more commonly a regular part of the evaluation at diagnosis. And so one of the questions is, should the PORTO criteria for diagnostic workup be revisited and perhaps new instructions and recommendations given?
But now we have the question again of progression and of development and of, as always, the hope that accurate classification can lead to better prognosis and more successful intervention. Dhaliwal et al. Phenotypic variation in pediatric inflammatory bowel disease by age. Does that mean by age at presentation or by individuals as they age?
It means by age at presentation. So Jaz Dhaliwal, who trained in the UK largely, was then a fellow in Toronto with us and now is a faculty in Cincinnati. But we published that paper based on thorough diagnostic workup of an inception cohort of children and adolescents who were presenting at sites across Canada. And the paper was based on the first 1,000 patients at the time of their diagnostic workup. And there had always been this knowledge that when IBD develops in young children, it involves predominantly the colon. And it's only when IBD presents later on in childhood or adolescence, young adults, does it involve more commonly the small bowel as well as the colon. But we were interested in this cohort to look at what age does that change actually take place? And the answer was that it was, in fact, a gradual thing. So if you looked at a six-year-old, they had a greater predominance of colon-only IBD than did a 12-year-old. But the change from 6 to 12 was sort of, or from under 6 to 12 was sort of gradual. And then certainly by 12, by after 10, you had similar prevalence of the different locations of IBD as you would see in older adolescents and young adults. Interestingly, in the elderly who develop IBD, you're back again to having dominantly colonic IBD.
I'm so used to thinking about pediatric patients that I've really forgotten that sometimes this disorder, these disorders, can and do develop in, speaking from the heights of 70, at advanced age.
Yes, that's true. That's true. And the IOIBD 25 classification is making the cutoff above 60 as defining elderly or later onset IBD.
But let's get back to kids.
Sure.
And let's talk about the appraisal of the PIBD, pediatric IBD classes criteria.
Yes.
A multicentral multi-center validation.
Yes.
Tell us how that was organized and what the findings were.
Yes, it's very interesting. It came out of the Porto group of Espigan, which really has been a very hardworking and prolific group that has advanced the field of pediatric IBD a lot. And I say that as a Canadian, you know, although I am now a member of the Porto group, but all of this happened before I was. So you try to classify IBD into Crohn's disease, one of the Crohn's diseases, if you like, and ulcerative colitis. But sometimes it's difficult. And that's when you start to use the term IBD unclassified or IBDU.
Mm-hmm.
That was a term that was used first as part of the Montreal classification. And they simply said, if there are features of Crohn's and there are features of ulcerative colitis and you can't be sure which it fits in, then call it IBDU. But the Porto group went beyond that.
Uh-huh.
And they tried to define clear criteria for when the label should be used. And what they did was they got physicians from 23 different sites to send in detailed information about patients at their center who had predominantly colonic IBD. And they asked them, tell us all the features, then tell us, are you calling it ulcerative colitis? Are you calling it Crohn's colitis? Or are you calling it IBDU?
Mm-hmm.
And so the gold standard was what the physician had said, you know, not the strongest gold standard, but that's what was used. So out of that, all these features were put into classes. And a class one feature was automatically Crohn's disease. And so one of the class one features is a granuloma. So you as a pathologist might have a feeling about this. If everything is pointing to ulcerative colitis, it looks like it, it behaves like it, but a pathologist somewhere has said there's a granuloma, then that would automatically have to be Crohn's colitis. Now, the pathologists I've talked to haven't been very happy with that because, as I understand it and it's been taught to me, you can have crypt-associated granuloma and it really doesn't.
I think that as a pathologist, we would like to back away from taking so much responsibility for anything.
I see. right, yes. So I have a friend in Toronto, Bob Riddell. You may have known him well. And yes, he feels absolutely the same way. He sort of throws up his hands.
Then I feel very validated.
Yeah. Good, okay. Good. Yes. So, but still, it's a very helpful algorithm because it does make people come up with a consistent label. I don't think you should live and die by it, but it does direct your thoughts a bit. Now, the Scottish group of pediatric gastroenterologists recently published a paper that looked at what happened over time to children who were labeled as having IBDU. And the majority of them over time could be identified as having either ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. So the IBDU label is often a provisional label that clarifies with time. That's how I like to see it.
Anne-Marie, we're drawing close to the end of the amount of time available for us to carry on this discussion. And at this juncture, I'd like to ask, what else would you like to mention about these classifications, their utility, and how you see them evolving and developing before we move on to say goodbye to our listeners?
Well, what we hope with the IOIBD 25 classification, which is bringing together adult IBD and pediatric IBD, so part of a continuum, what we hope is that by adding such detail to the descriptions of patients, as science continues to progress, as we get more and more data on the microbiome, transcriptome, proteomics, that perhaps eventually we will be able to classify our patients not just by a description of what we see, but by some molecular data, mechanistic data that will guide our therapy better.
Finally, molecular data underneath the same big roof.
That's right, and enabling personalized treatment for children and adults with IBD.
Well, speaking as somebody with USA citizenship, talking with you today makes me proud to welcome you as a member of our 51st state. I don't mean that seriously. I really don't. Okay.
We're used to it.
Oh, no. Please don't say that.
No, we're used to hearing it.
Okay. But let's hold the flag. Let's hold the maple leaf high today. And let's see whether or not the song that you've chosen to contribute to our Spotify Espigan Favorite Songs, Espigan Podcast Favorite Songs playlist is a Canadian one. What song would you like to contribute?
Well, let's have a Canadian female, and let's go with Alanis Morissette, Hand in My Pocket.
I'd have plumped for Katie Lang myself, but what the heck. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.